Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Trying to keep up with the stock market these days, it feels like juggling water, doesn't it? So much information flying around.
It really does. Constant noise.
And what we really need is a way to, you know, cut through that noise and just grab the insights that actually count.
Exactly. Filter it down.
And that's really what we try to do here on The Deep Dive. We dig into the source material, try to pull out the crucial bits for you efficiently.
And today you're diving in with us to get a handle on the core ideas of value investing.
Right. Our guide for this is drawn from The 5 Keys to Value Investing.
Think of this as your fast track to understanding what value investing is really all about. We'll pull out the main principles, maybe even some surprising facts along the way.
Okay, so value investing, we hear it all the time.
Yeah.
But what's the philosophy behind it?
Well, the source makes it pretty clear right off the bat. It's not just about stock prices jumping around on a screen.
What?
No. True value investors, they're thinking about owning a piece of an actual business, you know, a real company.
Mm.
With products, ideas, a management team, goals.
That perspective shift is huge, isn't it? Thinking, okay, behind this stock symbol, there's a team. People making decisions that either build value or, well, destroy it.
Absolutely. And what's really interesting is how things have changed for, like, the individual investor.
How so?
Well, the book points out that, yeah, professionals used to have huge advantages. Direct access to CEOs, maybe getting information early.
Right, the old who you know kind of thing.
Exactly. But now the playing field is, well, it's a lot more level. 3 big things are helping individual investors compete.
Okay, what are they?
Technology and the internet, first off. Then there's regulation FD. And finally, greater accounting transparency.
Okay, let's break those down. The internet's impact seems obvious, right? Mm-hmm. Access to information is just night and day compared to a few decades ago.
Totally. Now you can pull up SEC filings, the 10-Ks, the 10-Qs almost instantly. Companies put out quarterly updates, webcasts of earnings calls. You're practically in the room.
So the edge isn't about secret info anymore. It's about who can best analyze the stuff that's, well, basically available to everyone.
Precisely. And Regulation FD, that stands for Fair Disclosure, that was a big one.
What did that do exactly?
It basically stopped companies from selectively leaking important non-public info to just a few analysts or big institutions.
So leveling the information playing field.
Right. If a company has something significant to say, they have to say it publicly so everyone gets it at the same time. Individuals, big funds, everyone.
And the third point, accounting transparency.
Yeah, the big accounting scandals back in the early 2000s, Enron, WorldCom. terrible stuff, obviously.
They definitely shook confidence.
But the silver lining, according to the source, was this push for much greater transparency. Investors got way more skeptical, started digging deeper into how companies report their numbers.
And that pressure forced companies to be clearer, more upfront.
That's the argument. More clarity, fuller disclosure, which ultimately helps all investors, right? Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
So connecting this to practice, the book talks about mutual series. Max Heine, Michael Price. Like a value think tank.
Yeah, exactly. Their whole philosophy, boiled down, was pretty simple but powerful. Try to buy a dollar's worth of assets for, say, 60 cents.
Find those bargains.
Find the bargains, but do it through really rigorous, deep analysis. It was this collaborative environment. You know, people like Peter Langerman, Robert Friedman, David Winters, they were all part of this culture. It heavily influenced the author.
Buying a dollar for 60 cents.
Yeah.
Just sounds logical, doesn't it?
It does. But the book really hammers home another point, emotional discipline.
Ah, the psychological side.
Absolutely critical. You need a framework, a system, so you don't get swept up in market moods or panic when things get choppy.
Like that Peter Lynch quote they mentioned. Even after decades, he admits he has no idea where the market's going short term.
Right. His focus was always buy good companies. Forget trying to time the market swings.
So how does this mindset deal with, like, major world events, wars, crashes, the stuff that really spooks the market?
The book touches on that. World War I, Pearl Harbor, the Korean War. Yeah, markets tanked initially. Of course they did.
But long term?
Long term, the focus comes back to the underlying driver, corporate earnings. Growth tends to resume. Again, it's about the companies, not just the headlines.
And speaking of long term drags, inflation gets a mention. Buffett's view is pretty stark, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. He called it a fantastic ability to simply consume capital, like a hidden tax, but way more destructive.
And trying to time the market to avoid inflation.
Buffett suggests that's usually a fool's errand. Very difficult, maybe impossible to do consistently.
So you have the philosophy, the history, the warnings.
Yeah.
But the book stresses that just knowing this isn't enough, right?
Not at all. The real challenge, the constant battle, is execution. Sticking to the discipline.
With all the noise. Mm-hmm. Analysts yelling buy, sell, hold. Gurus making predictions.
Exactly. It takes real mental fortitude to stay your course, stick to your valuation framework, and not get swayed by the crowd. That's where many people stumble.
Okay, mindset established. Let's get into the nuts and bolts. How do value investors actually assess a business?
Right. We're back to that core idea.
Yeah.
You're buying a business, not a stock quote.
So you need a framework for that.
And the book lays out these five keys of value. It's a structure for thinking it through.
What are the five?
Okay, number one, understand the business itself. Two, assess the price. Three, determine its intrinsic value. Four, identify potential catalysts. And five, establish a margin of safety.
Let's start with understanding the business. How do you do that practically? Public filings.
That's the bedrock. The annual report, especially the Form 10-K, it's dense, but it's where the real information lives.
What parts are most important in the 10K?
The management's discussion and analysis, the MD&A, is key. It's supposed to be an honest look from management about how things are going, the financial condition, risks on the horizon, you know, without the marketing spin.
Right. Less glossy pictures, more substance.
Exactly. Though you get the glossy pictures, too, and the shareholder letter, which is often, let's say, optimistic.
Uh-huh. Yeah, usually.
But the real meat, financial statements and, crucially, the footnotes.
Ah, the footnotes. Always sounds like where they hide the important stuff.
Sometimes it feels like it. But seriously, that's where you find details on accounting methods, big contracts, potential lawsuits, inventory breakdown. Sometimes even comments that are less rosy than the main text.
So value investors are reading those footnotes looking for.
Red flags, basically. Anything that looks weird. Accounting that doesn't seem to match the actual economic reality of the business, or big differences compared to how competitors do things.
And the main financial statements. Income statement.
Vital. Gives you a sense of future earnings potential, the company's underlying earnings power. Ben Graham's point is relevant here. You can't predict the future, but past and current earnings are usually your best guide.
Balance sheet. What does that tell you?
It's a snapshot of financial health, assets, liabilities, equity. But a big limitation is historical cost accounting.
Meaning assets are listed at what the company originally paid for them, not their current value.
Exactly. That piece of land they bought 50 years ago could be worth way more now, but it sits on the books at the old price.
Good point. And the cash flow statement.
hugely important. Right. We'll come back to it as a valuation approach, but it shows where the actual cash is coming from and going to.
Okay, so that's analyzing the company itself. What about the industry it operates in?
Here, the book brings in Michael Porter's Five Forces. It's a classic framework.
Right, I remember that from business school. Threat of new entrants.
Power of buyers, power of suppliers, threat of substitutes, and the rivalry among existing competitors.
And understanding those forces helps you figure out
how much pricing power a company might have, what its costs might look like, how intense the competition is. Basically, the overall attractiveness of the industry.
And within that industry, companies compete differently.
Right.
Cost leadership, differentiation.
Yeah, Porter's generic strategies, cost leadership, differentiation, or focusing on a specific niche. The book notes that investors tend to prefer companies with a clear, focused strategy. Be the cheapest, or be unique, or serve a specific group really well. Don't try to be everything to everyone.
Makes sense. Beyond the numbers and industry structure, the book mentions trying to understand a company's intent.
Yeah, looking at their corporate strategy, their operations strategy, their financial strategy. What are they trying to achieve? How are they planning to get there? It gives you clues about future profitability.
And you mentioned a cash flow-based approach earlier.
Very common, very insightful. It helps you gauge the quality of the earnings reported on the income statement. Is the company actually generating cash?
How is free cash flow defined here?
Basically, net income, add back non-cash charges like depreciation, then subtract the cash the company has to spend to maintain its business, usually capital expenditures or CapEx.
And looking at the trend of that free cash flow over time.
Tells you a lot about financial strength, flexibility, whether they need to borrow money or issue stock constantly. It's a reality check.
What about the people running the show? Management assessment.
Critically important, though maybe harder to quantify. Value investors want management that thinks and acts like owners. Are they good stewards of shareholder capital?
Like Buffett often talks about.
Exactly. The source mentions his guidance, though doesn't go into extreme detail in this section. It's about alignment of interests.
To tie this together, there's a case study. Herman Miller. What were the key takeaways there?
Well, first, the office furniture industry wasn't as cyclical as you might think. It was actually growing faster than the overall economy.
Interesting.
And Herman Miller was gaining market share within that growing market. Plus, management seemed prepared for a potential slowdown, focusing on costs.
Anything else stand out?
Their adoption of EVA economic value added. It's a performance metric specifically designed to measure if a company is generating returns above its cost of capital. They linked it to incentive compensation, which is a good sign, aligning management pay with creating actual shareholder value.
Okay, so we've dug deep into understanding the business and industry. Now let's pivot to the other side, price and value. How do you assess those?
Right, the second and third keys. And they're intrinsically linked. The book says you can't really understand the stock price without understanding how a rational buyer would value the whole enterprise.
Makes sense. What tools do value investors use for valuation?
There's a whole toolkit. And different investors have their preferences. Price to earnings, PE, price to book, PB, enterprise value to EBITDA, discounted cash flow, DCF.
Let's touch on those. PE ratio, price to earnings. When is that most useful?
Best for stable, financially sound companies without huge, lumpy capital spending needs coming up.
But it's not the whole picture.
Definitely not. The book makes a great point. Long-term stock prices follow cash flow growth more than just accounting earnings. Management skill in generating cash is key.
Okay. Price to book, PB.
Simple concept. Market price compared to the company's accounting book value per share. Book value, net worth, shareholder equity, basically the same thing. Market cap is the stock market's value.
What are the downsides of PB?
Well, book value itself is affected by accounting choices, like depreciation methods. And it's less helpful for tech or service companies where intangible assets, brands, patents, software are way more important than physical assets. Book value doesn't capture those well.
Right. Intangible assets are huge now. What about EBITDA? Enterprise value to earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. Sounds complicated.
It's a mouthful. Yeah. But it's popular, especially with private equity and for companies with negative or depressed earnings right now. Adding back depreciation and amortization gives a sense of cash earnings before financing and taxes.
But it has shortcomings, too.
Oh, yeah. Doesn't work well for holding companies. Can be tricky if there are minority stakes in other businesses. You might need to adjust the numbers.
Are there other EV metrics?
Several. EV to revenue, EVR, often used with industry growth context. EV to EBIT, which is before D&A, EV to EBITDA minus CapEx, trying to get closer to free cash flow, EV to cash flow itself.
EVBT, you said, is good for industries with steady maintenance CapEx.
Yeah, where capital spending is more about upkeep than massive growth projects.
Okay, and the big one, discounted cash flow, DCF.
The theoretical gold standard for some. You project the company's future free cash flows and discount them back to their present value.
What drives the DCF value?
Two big things. The cash flow projections themselves and the discount rate you use. That rate is usually the WACC, weighted average cost of capital.
WACC. Remind me what goes into that.
It's the blended cost of the company's financing. It considers the cost of equity, which shareholders expect.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
The cost of debt, interest rates adjusted for tax savings, and the mix of debt and equity the company uses.
So lots of assumptions go into DCF.
Huge assumptions. That's its weakness. It's really hard to use reliably for companies with volatile cash flows or those going through major changes, because who knows what the future cash flows or the right discount rate will be.
Any other valuation methods mentioned?
Transaction-based comps. Looking at what similar companies were bought or sold for in recent M&A deals, you often have to calculate the multiples yourself from the deal info.
Let's go back to Herman Miller. How did the valuation play out there? The stock was around $17.
Yeah, early 99. So after assessing the business, good industry, gaining share, smart management, they looked at valuation.
Using multiple tools.
Right.
Looked at historical and estimated future free cash flow, EBITDA, EBITDA less CapEx, then applied PE, DCF, and a potential takeout valuation, what an acquirer might pay, maybe based on, say, 8x next year's estimated EBITDA.
And the result.
Averaging those methods gave an implied value around $26 a share, significantly higher than the $17 market price at the time, a potential bargain.
The analysis also looked at various EV multiples and the takeout scenario in more detail.
Yeah, digging into the implied enterprise value, adjusting for debt and cash to get to an equity value. The book even shows snippets of their income statement, cash flow, and balance sheet data for context.
Okay, so you've assessed the business, you've valued it, and maybe you see it's trading below your estimated value?
Yeah.
What's next? Do you just buy?
Not necessarily. This brings us to the fourth key, catalyst identification.
Catalyst, meaning something that will make the market realize the value you see.
Exactly. It's an event, a trigger, something that can unlock that underlying value and get the stock price moving closer to its intrinsic worth.
What kinds of catalysts are there?
Several types. One is improved operational efficiency. Like new management comes in, cuts costs, boosts margins, especially in companies that have been underperforming.
But be careful about promises there.
Yeah, the book warns about being skeptical of overly optimistic cost-cutting promises. Easy to say, hard to do. Changes in financial strategy. Maybe they refinance debt smartly, lower their cost of capital, or find ways to sustainably lower their tax rate multinational strategies using past losses. Even smoother, more predictable earnings can be a catalyst.
Share buybacks. Companies buying their own stock.
That's a common one. Returns cash to shareholders. Signals management thinks the stock is cheap. Increases earnings per share. Can change the capital structure. But again, they need to be careful not to overpay for their own stock.
What about bigger restructuring things? Spinoffs.
Spinoffs and equity carve-outs, yeah. A spinoff creates a whole new separate public company from a division usually tax-free. An equity carve-out sells a chunk of a division to the public via an IPO, raising cash for the parent.
Why do companies do spinoffs?
Lots of reasons. Maybe to refocus the parent company on its core business. Maybe the market will value the two separate companies more highly than the combined one. Sometimes regulators require it. Can improve credit ratings too. strategic fit issues.
And sometimes even liquidation can be a catalyst.
In extreme cases, yes. If a company is in a dying business and its stock price is below what its tangible assets could be sold for, liquidation might unlock more value for shareholders.
Are there external catalysts too? Things outside the company's direct control?
Definitely. Shareholder activists are a big one. Individuals or funds pushing management for changes, sell assets, change strategy, improve governance, trying to unlock value.
And mergers and acquisitions. M&A.
Huge category. Companies buy each other for scale, hoping to cut costs, get synergies, or for diversification. Though the book notes diversification doesn't always create value, sometimes you get that conglomerate discount.
Conglomerate discount, meaning the market values the combined company less than the pieces would be worth separately.
Yeah, often happens when companies get too complex or diversified into unrelated areas. Management focus gets diluted.
Okay, so identify the value, identify the catalyst. What's the fifth key?
The margin of safety. This is maybe the most famous value investing concept, thanks to Benjamin Graham.
Remind us what it is.
It's simply the difference between your estimate of a security's intrinsic value and the price you actually pay. It's your buffer, your cushion.
Protection against being wrong.
Exactly. Protection against errors in your valuation, which will happen, and protection against unexpected bad news or negative events. It's all about downside protection.
How do you actually calculate or assess it?
Several ways. Liquidation value is one. What are the tangible assets worth net of liabilities? You'd usually discount things like inventory or specialized equipment and ignore intangibles like goodwill.
What else?
Replacement cost is similar. What would it cost to rebuild the business's assets today? Cash is worth cash. Property might be worth more than book value. Equipment needs a conservative estimate.
Some of the parts valuation again.
Yeah, that can be a way to find a margin of safety too. Value each division separately. Is the market giving you one of the divisions essentially for free compared to the total market cap? Requires good quantitative and qualitative judgment.
The book also talks about risk versus uncertainty here.
Important distinction. Risk in this context is usually seen as quantifiable, company-specific stuff, business risk. Uncertainty is the stuff you can't quantify, the unknowns.
And value investors focus more on
managing the business risk they can analyze. They try not to predict the unquantifiable market risk or uncertainties, but they do try to take advantage of market volatility caused by fear or uncertainty.
Like buying good companies when the whole market panics?
Exactly. Like during the 98 Asian Latin American crisis example, uncertainty could be accounting scandals popping up or companies suddenly going private. Stuff that's hard to foresee.
There's another case study here, Maytag. How did margin of safety apply?
They dug into the 10K footnotes again, trying to estimate a bare bones asset value.
A conservative estimate.
Very. Cash at full value, receivables discounted, inventory discounted, intangibles at zero, PP&E maybe close to book. Just trying to see what the absolute floor might be.
And the author's personal experience with Maytag.
They bought it, monitored it for catalysts, but after a year, the catalysts didn't happen, the business didn't improve, and they reassessed the margin of safety. It wasn't compelling anymore, so they sold, even though the price had dropped. Discipline.
Selling because the original thesis is broken, not just because the price went down.
Precisely.
Okay, we have the five keys. Now, how do you pull it all together to find actual investment opportunities? What kinds of situations should you look for?
The book outlines a few types. One is just out-of-favor companies. Maybe the market hates them right now, but the underlying value, private market, sum of parts, asset value, is high, giving you a good margin of safety. Potential acquisition targets often fit here.
What about growth? Is value investing only about cheap, boring companies?
You know, not at all. High growth opportunities can be value investments too, but you have to be really confident that the growth is sustainable. The Network Associates case study looked at valuation multiples, but also catalysts like operational improvements and a potential McAfee.com carve out.
Cyclical industries.
Yep. Long-term cyclical plays. Needs patience. New Whole Land and Farming was an example, betting on a Southern California economic recovery, knowing you might have to wait.
Can you have cyclicals with near-term catalysts?
Sure. Eaton Corporation was mentioned strong cyclical businesses, but also a restructuring plan that could boost things sooner.
Event-driven situations.
Things like restructurings, bankruptcies. Thermo Electron was complex, maybe undervalued because of its complexity, and had planned spin-offs as catalysts.
And hybrid opportunities. A mix of things.
Right. Pactiv Core was an example. Cyclical benefit from lower resin prices, plus internal stuff like cost cuts, debt reduction, selling off parts. Margin safety came from assets, cash flow, brands. It worked out well.
But you have to be careful not to fall into value traps, right?
Absolutely. Cheap stocks that stay cheap because there's no catalyst, or the industry is just slowly dying. That's not value investing, that's just buying cheap junk.
And emotional discipline comes back again.
Always. Don't sell good companies just for a quick profit. Don't buy just because the stock is hot, off its dumbest reason. Don't sell good companies just because the market is down. Those down days can be buying opportunities if you're prepared.
Okay, say you found a promising company, done the work. How do you approach buying right and thinking like an owner?
Need that mental framework again. Be aware of the big picture. Interest rates, corporate profits, inflation.
Interest rates, Buffett's gravity analogy.
Act on financial valuations the way gravity acts on matter. Higher rates generally pull valuations down. Keep an eye on the Fed funds rate, the yield curve. They impact the economy and profits.
Corporate profits, the long-term driver.
Over the long haul, yeah, that's what ultimately supports stock prices.
And monitor inflation. Using which indexes?
GDP deflator, broad, PPI, producer prices, often leading. CPI, consumer prices, cost of living. Inflation eats away at your real returns.
Thinking like an owner also means understanding corporate governance. Board of directors.
Yep. The board represents shareholders. Understand share classes common, voting, preferred, maybe no vote, fixed dividend.
Shareholder rights.
Write your reports, earnings calls, the annual meeting. The book mentions Lynn's Investor's Bill of Rights, emphasizing management as stewards, transparency, independent auditors, engaged boards, shareholder votes on big stuff. Real analysis.
How should you use quarterly earnings announcements?
Look beyond the headline EPS number. Compare year over year, quarter over quarter. Check sales growth, operating income, margins. Exclude one-time items. Crucially, listen to management's explanation and outlook. Tone matters.
The book suggests a two-step process.
Yeah. Quick read for surprises, then dig deeper into the numbers, assess the quality. The Pactiv announcement example showed positive signals like strong cash flow, margin improvement.
Voting rights, proxy statements important for owners.
Definitely. Understand how voting works. Read the proxy. It has info on management plans, executive pay, how the stock has done versus peers. It's part of your duty as an owner.
The book also briefly lists criteria from Buffett and Graham.
Yeah, contrast Graham's focus on deep discount to tangible assets with Buffett's focus on quality businesses with moats and good management, bought at a reasonable price. Two giants, slightly different flavors of value.
Where do you actually hunt for ideas? Financial news.
Can be a starting point. Know what you're looking for. Company industry insights, potential catalysts, valuation clues. The book walks through reading the Wall Street Journal, what's news, who's news, the data banks for big movers, market columns, mentions Forbes, Fortune, IBD, NYT2.
And online resources now?
Huge advantage for individual investors. Tons of data, free screeners, SEC's AGJR database for all the filings is indispensable.
Okay, last big topic, building your own portfolio.
Right, first step, understand your own risk tolerance, your goals. Then the diversification question.
Diversify widely or focus?
The eternal debate. Buffett famously favors focus for knowledgeable investors, maybe 5-10 stocks you understand deeply. He sees broad diversification as protection against ignorance.
But even in a focused portfolio, you diversify somewhat.
Yeah, maybe across industries or types of opportunities, restructuring, cyclical, growth. Don't put all your eggs in one type of basket either.
And the goal isn't just market returns.
For an actively managed portfolio, no. You should aim to beat the market over time, otherwise just buy a cheap index fund. Over-diversifying without deep knowledge just leads to mediocre index-like returns, but with higher fees or effort.
Wow. We have covered a ton of ground on value investing. Any final big takeaways?
I think the core themes are really long-term perspective. Mm-hmm. Emotional discipline is paramount. Rigorous research, know the business, know the value, and actively look for those catalysts. It's a cohesive process.
So for you listening, think about how these ideas apply to your own investing. Can you look past the daily noise? Can you focus on the underlying business value?
It really boils down to becoming a business analyst first and a stock picker second.
That leads to a really interesting final thought the book implicitly raises, especially for today. With intangible assets, brands, network effects, data, software becoming so dominant in the economy, how does that traditional margin of safety calculation, which often relied heavily on tangible book value or liquidation value, need to evolve?
That's a fantastic question. How do you create a buffer when the most valuable assets don't appear accurately on the balance sheet, or maybe don't appear at all?
Definitely something to chew on as you apply these principles going forward.
Yeah, it requires adapting the mindset, maybe focusing even more on earnings power, cash flow, and competitive advantages as the source of safety.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully this deep dive gave you a solid foundation. If specific areas grabbed your interest, definitely dig deeper into those.
Thanks for joining us.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
You know what's the scariest part of October? Being vulnerable to cyber criminals. That's why this Cyber Scaries Month, you need Webroot Total Protection. With all-in-one protection for your devices, privacy, and identity, Webroot Total Protection helps defend every part of your digital life. Change your October from cyber scary to cyber secure with 60% off Webroot Total Protection at www.webroot.com/audio. That's 60% off for a limited time, but only when you go to www.webroot.com/audio.